I'm Jason Michael Perry, the man with three first names, and this is Thoughts on Tech and Things. I just spent the last week in my hometown for Mardi Gras, and after all the parades died down, I met up with someone I've been wanting to talk to for a while, Andy Quick. Andy spent more than 30 years at a company called Entergy. It's a Fortune 500 company that focuses on energy that's headquartered in New Orleans, and he was also one of the first chief AI officers in the country. Over his time, he's helped Entergy build out their AI strategy, creating this entirely from the ground up. Late last year, Andy retired, and this felt like this was probably the perfect time to catch up. Now, as many of you may know, last year I wrote a book, The AI Evolution, that traces the creation of many C-suite jobs like the chief information officer, chief technology officer, or security officers, and also argues about the need for a chief AI officer in companies, the same role that Andy served. So I thought, what better person to talk about the role of the chief AI officer and what this person actually does? So Andy and I caught up in the lobby of the Westin Hotel in New Orleans to talk about this. But before we dig in, let's look at the headlines that define the moment. In my book, The AI Evolution, I trace how major technology shifts have ended up creating new C-suite roles. PCs gave us rise to the CIO, the chief information officer. The dot-com era gave us the software developers and chief technology officers, and cybersecurity breaches led to chief information security officers. And I believe that now we're seeing that same thing happen and finding a need for an AI officer. So when we look at where we are now, a new study that was reported by CIO Dive looked at 35,000 public and private U.S. companies in 2024 and found that 51 had a formal chief AI officer. And that was up from 30 in 2023. Now, I'm imagining that when we get the numbers for 2025, and of course now in 2026, we're going to start to see that AI leadership is increasing. But still, there's a lot of organizations that are trying to figure out how to manage AI. And this raises a question. If almost no one has created someone or given someone the hat to make them a dedicated person focused on AI strategy, what does the actual adoption look like? Well, Gallup released a Q4 2025 workspace AI tracking report, and their answer is that it's split. About 51% of U.S. workers now report using AI at work and at work on a regular basis. And 49%, which is essentially half the workspace, says that they never use the tool. And when you zoom into that, it gets even more interesting because workers who are remote capable, knowledge work folks, you know, those types of roles, the adoption is higher. 66% are using AI and 40% are using it frequently, you know, defined as a few times a week. So in short, companies are spending billions and billions of dollars on AI. Billions of dollars trying to push adoption in AI, but the adoption is dragging behind. The return on investment isn't there. And this is something that I hear with clients and companies that I work with all the time, that they're just not seeing the value, even though the expectations are so high. And that's exactly what I want to dig into with Andy. So as always, links are in the show notes, and let's get into it with Andy. Andy Quick is a former chief AI officer of Entergy, a Fortune 500 energy company based in New Orleans. After nearly 30 years with the organization, leading data, automation, digital transformation, he was tapped to build and lead the company's AI strategy at the board level. He stood up a dedicated AI function, built a pipeline of initiatives valued at more than $100 million, and helped a highly regulated utility navigate one of the fastest technology shifts we've ever seen. So with that, I want to welcome Andy to the show. How are you doing?
Good. Good to see you, Jason.
So the place I was hoping to start is to understand Entergy's thoughts and how it was embracing AI. And I say this because you were one of the earliest companies that I know, especially Fortune 500 companies, to appoint a chief AI officer, which meant that you must have felt the urgency and the need pretty immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know, it was the early days of AI, and there was a belief that a lot of value, you know, could be had from investing and implementing AI at scale at the company. So whether it's to improve affordability for customers, reliability of power. There are a lot of reasons where, you know, AI could show up and, you know, create value. So, but yes, it was early.
So do you have a way that you would define your job description, your role, or your mandate, especially with something that shifted so much? I imagine what it was before retirement, what it was when you first started, and just over that duration that maybe you rewrote that job description in your head 5 or 10 times?
Yeah, it was because there wasn't a blueprint. There wasn't like a real analog. There wasn't another company doing it. There wasn't like a cookbook or, you know, so a lot of it was kind of OG, kind of create this thing from the ground up. And so, and two things were happening. One, everybody was learning. So everybody came in at AI at a different kind of IQ or level of experience with it, myself included. So you had that, people were learning. Then you had sort of a range of expectations. There are people that, and even today this exists in companies, there's some trepidation, right? Well, this is AI, is this really a thing? Maybe there's a fear factor associated with it. And then there's others that think it's like magic dust. You just sort of sprinkle it and all these amazing things would, you know, happen. So, and plus, the technology itself was evolving all the time. So as soon as you kind of get your head wrapped around a particular tool or technology or model, there'd be something new and then something new. And so just keeping up all at the same time was really, really challenging.
That magic dust piece is something that I hear from a lot of executives when I talk about AI, that the expectations were through the roof, that this was going to just, you know, suddenly quadruple revenue, you know, make all the processes easy. And some of what I have found is that the old principles are still true. Like, if your data is messed up, it's still a problem. That a lot of the things that, almost like taking your regular medicine, like all the medicine that you've been avoiding, was incredibly important to unlock some of the powers of AI, to really get to that, I don't know if you'd ever call it magic dust, but to some of the possibilities.
You really hit the nail on the head with that comment. I've been doing, you know, change my whole career, technology and change. All my 35 years, it's all I've done is, you know, integrating some form of technology, whether it's legacy software, automation, data models, AI, into somebody's life, somebody's work. And there still has to be change that has to happen to create value. And that's the lesson that just keeps getting relearned. And AI, I think some people sort of thought I think there are people out there that thinks it can be sort of skipped. But at the end of the day, getting value from any tech, including AI, requires you to go through change. And so all those tenets of, you know, focusing on change management to be able to use technology, to be able to get the value, to be able to say, yeah, that's magic dust. You can't skip that. And, you know, I find now that I'm an advisor, I still see this with other, you know, clients. They just sort of want to jump into the AI and think that it itself is going to, you know, herald the coming of all this value without going through the real hard work of figuring out your data, understanding change, people. It's really more of a human exercise in getting people to change than it is the technology itself. But in the early days, and I think it's still out there, there's just this expectation that we just sort of put this AI in place and all these good things are going to happen. But the hard work is the change. Can't skip it.
Yes, I hear that. The thing that I find all the time is that I walk into an organization, I know that you're consulting, you're working with organizations in a similar way, that you walk in and you find that, hey, we bought ChatGPT for everybody. No one's using it. We don't understand, but everyone has the tools. Everyone has what they need. And it's much more complicated than that. Just to get any tool entrenched and used within an organization. You know, this is cultural. This is change. There are a lot of things that are bigger than this. And I think what gets lost with the role of the chief AI officer, to kind of get to a question here, is that so many look at it as a very technical thing, like the technical piece of what AI, but I think it's more than that.
Yeah, I agree. I wish it was more technical because it sounds really kind of cool and fun. Unfortunately, or fortunately, or the reality is that that's not where I spent any of my time, or less of my time, I should say. It's all about change. It's all about managing expectations. And it's all about being very thoughtful and smart around how you actually deploy this stuff and being intentional and critical of trying to find ways to make those discretionary investments in AI that will actually create value. Because at the end of the day, any chief AI officer is going to be accountable for value creation, right? As they should. So as you're navigating what tools to deploy, what use cases to pursue, buy, build, all these kind of questions, you can't lose your eye off the ball of, well, how are you going to create that value? And you've got to navigate and control, to the extent you're able to, where you're going to make those investments and be smart of connecting, you know, the value, which may mean you need to say no to some things. But that's where spending most of my time is, figuring out where do we deploy AI.
And the where, the understanding processes throughout your organization, you know, the SOP, standard operating procedures that exist on how we do this and how we do that. And you know, some of these processes, especially I imagine in a company as old and as large as the company that you work for, there are so many things that just have happened over time. And so I imagine that a lot of this is not only knowing that you have the data to back up these processes and use AI to maybe make them different or better or more performant, but it's also understanding organizationally the way that you do things.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. And I think spotting, you know, I forget how you phrased it, Jason, before. You made a comment about the same lessons being learned. And again, here we are again, the same place. It really is, it comes back to innovation. And where does innovation start? Innovation starts with problems. and really starting there and not getting caught in the trap of finding ideas to use AI, search for the problems to be solved, then see how AI might be able to solve it. Otherwise, you will chase, you know, hundreds of use cases that are, quote, good for AI for use, but will deliver very, very little incremental value. And working with business leadership to focus on what, you know, don't think about how to apply AI. Think about where your biggest frictions are, your biggest problems are at a senior level enough in the organization so that change can then get championed. Because at the end of the day, people will have to change to be able to integrate AI in a way to create value. So it really comes back to, number one, finding the frictions, the problems that very senior people care about, and starting there. And then it really is digital transformation. You know, it's kind of, AI is the, you know, the veneer of what I do. It's really just digital transformation, right? Now, AI is very powerful. It's got lots of tools that are new, are transformational, are different, but it's just another tool in the digital transformation tool belt versus its own thing. And what is digital transformation all about? Change, right? It's all about change.
You know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about what makes this moment unique. And the more I think about it, the more I wonder how, if it really is unique or if it's just, you know, reliving the same thing over again. So digital transformation and the things that I'm hearing sound so much like it was with the web. The web was, you know, one of the biggest, you know, more recent transformations. You could say the same about personal computers. And in that change, in that shift, the way we did everything, the way that organizations were structured became a question. And some were able to embrace it faster than others. And I think that, you know, that kind of led to the Sears versus, you know, Amazon world that we live in. I mean, yeah. Hindsight's 2020. It's a lot easier to look back and say, maybe Sears was wrong. But at the time, you know, there was a lot of question about how this was all going to evolve.
Yeah, and I think the internet is the best analogy for what we are now experiencing. What happened in the beginning when the internet came out? There was a huge rush to build businesses around the internet. Many failed, yeah. Right? Many, majority failed. And, but then there was this sort of, but then there was a lot of learning that was happening. And then industry learned, okay, this is how we're gonna use the internet in a way that is valuable, right? And I think the same, we're in that sort of, I don't know what you call cycle, trough, curve, whatever you wanna call it, we're like, we're now figuring out like, how do we really use this stuff? And I think the winners are companies, industries that look at it as a marathon and not a sprint, yeah. As a thoughtful transformation of the value chain of a business, not the magic dust, yeah. Right? Because then you get caught in that trap of just, now, going quickly allows you to learn faster, as long as you're willing to take on the failures or the failed experiments and know that that's going to lead to something greater, I think that's the path to go on. But I think it's a great analogy.
And I think that's important too, because this technology, just as it was with the internet, and now as it is with AI, is happening so quickly that you have to run the experiments. You have to try, but you also have to understand that some of these experiments, regardless of the money and the investment that goes into it, they're gonna be throwaway, just because of the nature of the beast. The what we know now, like just thinking about myself, what I know now, a year, 2 years, 3 years ago, it's changed so greatly, and for the better, but still, the way I would have done something 3 years ago is entirely different, you know, today.
I totally agree. And the real key, I think, the winners are gonna be those that don't just run the experiments, but run the right experiments, you know, and not just like roll out tools, for example. You know, I see a lot of that. I talk to people that like, hey, we're gonna roll this out. And my first question is why? What do you hope to gain? What do you expect to learn? And being intentional around picking those right experiments with the intent of learning whether or not you might be able to experience a change that has, you know, some great benefit, not just let's try this out. I think that's gonna have a larger graveyard of failed experiments than being intentional around picking the right ones.
So I'm curious, as you say that, some of the organizations that I work with have developed cross-functional committees as a way to champion AI. Some have created super user groups. Some have working user groups. Some, I mean, there's all types of way, but you know, types of ways. Some of the biggest organizations that I've worked with are still competing on who's really in charge. They have, you know, a digital officer, a digital transformation officer, a data officer, and none of them quite have the ball, which is, I think, almost slowing it down more so. Like, are there suggestions that you think have worked or things that you think a company should think about?
So this comes up with a lot of the clients I advise also is, how do we set this up? How do we structure it? Is it in IT? Is it under, there are different camps, and I think everybody's trying to figure it out. Some believe it's tech, it goes in IT. Some believe it's very data-centric, should go under a data officer because it's all about the data. And third is it's its own thing, right? It's an independent AI function that has its own own beginning. I think any of those models can work. Oh, committees, user groups, communities, AI universities. I mean, I did all that stuff, right? And to learn, and I think engagement's super important. I don't know that there is a model that I would say I would push somebody to, or a winning structure that would actually work. I think at the end of the day, it does come back to the level of sponsorship that you have within the organization that's going to help champion change. So I think any of that can work if there's, again, every organization has a different culture. Some may be very hierarchical, some may not be. But to really get value from an investment in AI, the question is, who is gonna help affect change more than anything else. That trumps everything else. More than the data, the tools, the tech, the models, architecture, any of that. Okay, that's all important. But do you have the cultural courage to change how you work, to transform how you work with AI, to actually create some material value? Because if you can't do that, it doesn't matter. Everything else is secondary. And I've run into this wall my whole career, not just with AI. You know, I subscribe to sort of a three-pronged approach or three criteria dimensions to pick AI use cases. And desirability is the first one. Desirability, viability, and feasibility. Desirability is this a problem worth solving, right? And do you have the cultural courage? It's like, you know, we're gonna solve this problem. We're gonna change how we work so that this problem goes away. And we're going to go through the pain of change because we're gonna change. We're gonna happen to use AI. That's number one. So, you know, viability is there value? Are there benefits? And then feasibility is the last piece of it. Do you have data? Do you have enough data? Do you have quality data? Can you do it technically? That's almost never the failure switch. It's always desirability in my experience. Again, back to what you said before, it's the same lesson. It's just it's a different coat of paint. It's AI this go around. And there's been many coats of paints with tech. So to come all the way full circle, I know I kind of tangent a little bit there, is all those models, you can set all this stuff up to work as long as you have a champion within the organization. It's not the chief AI officer, because the chief AI officer, in whatever, and there could be different ways of structuring it, is there to, you know, propagate the use of AI throughout the company, but ultimately create a lot of value and change how it works. Well, the chief AI officer is not the one that's going to influence change. I mean, they will, but at the end of the day, if hundreds of people or thousands of people are going, if their jobs are going to change and they're going to change how they work, they're not reporting to the chief AI officer. They're rolling up to somebody else. And that somebody else has got to be the one beating, you know, the fist on the table.
And that, I think that's such an important statement. Because the adoption rates that some of these organizations are seeing, a lot of big organizations, they're finding that they've rolled out the tools. In some cases, they've rolled out the processes or changed things, but the actual adoption and use is not there. In the software world, we used to run into this all the time. We'd take this old terminal-based application that everyone hated, we'd rebuild the thing, make it so much better, and we'd roll out the new version, and everyone would despise it, no matter how good it was.
That's right.
Because it's not what they had learned to use. I could use this other thing, you know. It's easy to say we did it, we have the tools. It's easy to talk about the technical piece.
Oh, yeah.
But the other parts, I mean, that's hard.
And it is what's most important, all right? What you just said, that is, and it's no different, you know? Mainframe to client server, you know, you just go on. I mean, we're old enough to know these things. And what it really comes down to is change, but also design, right? You know, I'm a design thinking person, so it's all around human-centered design, design thinking, that's the start, right? You design around the people, and they will love it and use it.
Yes.
If you go off behind a curtain, you're like, let's pick a tool, then slam it on people, you'll have that resistance. Eventually, over years, you can force change, but it rarely ends up then getting, you know, sustainable long-term value from that change. It just becomes, I'm taking one tool and giving you something else, and you're not really creating value.
So there's something you said earlier that I want to circle back to, and that's build versus buy. This has been a thing in my mind for a bit now, and the reason is that a lot of companies buy software because it's so expensive to maintain, manage, and build custom platforms and custom software. And some decide to buy, I mean build, but when they do decide to build, it's common to build places where the IP is essential to your organization. But AI is really bringing up this question with vibe coding and the speed to write code on whether we should just build all the things. Now, I've asked this question before, and one of the things that, someone always reminds me of, though, is that you still have technical debt, you still have to support it, you know, with an organization, but where do you live on buy versus build, or do you find your views changing?
Well, I would say I'm going to give you kind of two answers, because you brought up the vibe coding thing, and it, I think about what the future of this looks like versus what we're dealing with today. I think the buy versus build question comes later in your thought process, meaning getting back to innovation, finding problems we're solving, dealing with change. Those are the front seat. The back seat is the buy versus build question. So following the problem, following what you're trying to achieve is the beginning point. Because if you're worrying about tools, whether you buy or you build, on the onset of like your AI journey, or you have a specific AI project you wanna do, and you find yourself in the early stage, you're getting off a starting line and you're asking yourselves, should we buy or should we build? Wrong question. Okay. No, it's the wrong question. It's like, why do you want to buy something or build something? And then you start tracing back to like, what is the root of what you're trying to solve? And I think if you can get back to, you know, defining the problem until you're blue in the face, understanding the problem as deeply as possible, understanding how people experience those problems as deeply as possible, then when you start ideating and coming up with, okay, how might this be different? Picture a world that would be different, reimagining work with AI, which is where you really get, I mean, you get real value by completely reimagining how a workflow works, for example. I mean, completely AI first mentality. Then the buy versus build decision becomes very, very easy, because then you kind of know what you want your future to be, and you can quickly look at the market and go, there is a solution, right? Maybe it's not 100%, but it's 80%. And you look at the economics of buying versus build, that may be the absolute right decision. Or maybe you've come up with something that doesn't exist, or maybe it exists in multiple things. Maybe you have to buy and you have to build. Maybe there are services that are provided by cloud providers where, well, there's already something there that we can use or configure and use with some light orchestration. You know, so to me, this buy versus build feels like a very binary kind of question, and I get the question all the time, all the time. And I think that should be parked until you've really thought through what are you trying to really achieve? Then I think the buy versus build becomes an easier question, and it rarely is one or the other. I rarely find that when you get to that stage, if you've really followed a human-centered design approach, you really, really understood the problem well, you really know what you're trying to achieve, there's rarely gonna be one thing you can buy or one thing you can build. It's just, oh, you know, it's going to be probably some sort of combination. But I talked to a client recently, you know, they rolled out Copilot, you know. I'm like, what do you think? It sucks. And that was literally what I heard. Yeah. Not my words, it was the client's words. And they rushed into something without really understanding. And that's a simple example. Yeah. But even at the enterprise scale, that's kind of what I think. Now, the vibe coding question, I do think it's going to reshape how we think around engineering software. I do. I think it'll have a major impact. We'll see to the full extent, but they're very powerful, and they're only getting better and better and better.
I always say, you know, this is the worst AI you ever use. And I also like to say that this is the like the AOL of the AI days. You know, even some folks have said, maybe ChatGPT is more like Netscape. And who knows? I mean, you know, to go back with the analogy. So I'm talking about your retirement. I mean, if we can use that. I mean, you're retired from Entergy, but exploring other things. I know a group that I've known in New Orleans, this group called Idea Village that focuses on helping entrepreneurs build all types of businesses. Yes. That's here in New Orleans, that you're an entrepreneur in residence for them. Correct. And that you also are taking on select opportunities here and there to help businesses, you know, figure out how to navigate this space.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I it's certainly not enough to add up to full-time work, but I'm having a lot of fun working with startups. I'm also working with another incubator out of Baton Rouge called Nexus Louisiana. I'll be joining their board actually this month. And but working with startups has been great. You know, it's been really, really fun to help entrepreneurs, you know, scale their businesses and, you know, be able to just lend my experience to help them be successful. It's been really fun.
That's awesome. I mean, and I thought the goal is not to be full-time, right? So you're trying to make that
yes.
right balance.
Okay. Having fun, keeping busy, having fun, but not overdoing it for sure.
So I have a parting question for you. Maybe this is a two-part, so maybe I shouldn't say parting question. So part one is I talk with people in all stratas of the world. You know, some are at mom and pops, some are working in retail, some are, you know, mid-level accidental, you know, AI managers because they're the point person has been appointed, you know, and some are just folks who are trying to like carry the pail, right? So I'm curious, you know, the first question, like, what is your suggestion for what they can do or how they should navigate from someone who's been doing this at a, you know, at a larger company?
You know, for a smaller company, I don't think that smaller companies are going to have enough discretionary, you know, capital to make a significant investment, you know, in artificial intelligence. You know, talking to some small, medium businesses, they're just not going to do something significant, nor should they. So I would say, to the extent they're able to, pay attention to the new AI tools that are rolling out in the market, right? To the extent you have that capacity. Number one. Two, pay attention to what your competition is doing as well, to the extent you're able to know or learn what your competition's doing, what tools and technology they're using, and to the extent you're able to experiment, right? To the extent you're able to experiment with the tools and very incrementally adopt the use of AI tools within your business, because small businesses can't get disrupted significantly too quickly. You know, it's just too fragile, right? They're just trying to get through the day to day, but just very slowly and through a lot of the software that businesses already use, pay attention to the roadmap for those software tools and whether AI either is a feature or is a feature to be added in the future. If not, consider looking at software that does at least have a point of view on integrating AI into their solution, because it will come, and small businesses are going to be more successful the more they use AI, and that will most likely come through the existing software suite that they're already using.
And that's, you know, tools like Microsoft Copilot, which you mentioned, but also Google Gemini, which I think is pretty amazing.
Yeah,
just embracing some of the tools that are already there within the suite of things that are available,
yes,
and seeing how you could use those now,
yes,
but you're not going to go build your own AI model.
No. And you're not going to make a significant investment in a piece of AI software. I think what you said is absolutely correct. Use the tools to the extent you're able to. Run small experiments, try things on for size, and you'll be surprised what you might learn. And if you have flexibility, if you're at a buy decision on, you know, software to run your business or you know, tools that you exist and use, and you're making a buy decision, think about, you know, looking hard at the options you have and which companies have an AI first mindset in where they're taking the product, so that you have more assurances that if you do invest in a software tool, you'll get the benefit of AI as those features start coming up in that product.
And that's I think, incredibly important. I know I said like last questions of a course, and this is how it goes, but it's important because if you're adopting a piece of software and that company is not dedicated to, you know, using AI as it evolves, then you're going to find that you're always behind because that solution is behind. But some of the companies that are leading the edge, which is what makes things like Anthropic's Claude and ChatGPT with OpenAI so compelling, is because it's both kind of living on the edge because you're seeing the stuff as it's coming out, but also you get to see what's possible as it's happening.
Absolutely. I would say, I'll have to put in a plug though, remember also to small businesses as well, is remember that hallucinations are real. Yeah. And there is risk, and it's important that in addition to using the tools, learn about some of the challenges that come with using some of these tools, in particular the hallucinations, and always make sure you have a human vetting, you know, decisions that are recommendations that are coming from the tools.
All right, so then the second part of that was, what are you excited about? What are the tools that you're using that get you excited, that you love to play with, or what do you have your eye out for?
Well, I use ChatGPT just because I started with that. I've experimented with all the tools. I think they're all great. ChatGPT was the first one I started using, and I use it pretty much, you know, every day. In terms of things I'm like sort of monitoring, tools, agentic development platforms, because I really think that if you really fast forward, that really is how AI is going to show up in society.
And for anyone who doesn't know, like agentic, like the, I mean, it's really the verb form of agent. And these are AI that can do workflows, do tasks, do things for you.
Absolutely. And the way to think about it, and look, we're old enough to see the evolution of technology since, for me, 70s, you know, since the dawn of computing, I guess. If you think about how people interact with software today, either apps or software that you're using on a computer, think about how you use it. You're using your hands, you're typing on a keyboard, you're moving a mouse around, you're filling out things, you're clicking buttons, like you have this interaction, this human interaction. And these software systems are designed and apps around data. So if you think about when you're using software app, you're creating something, data, you're updating data, like a lot of it's data centric. An AI agent does that for you. So think of it as like, that's the way I think about it when I explain agents, like it's now taking over that, right? And you're now interacting, your interface is different. Your interface is more of a human interface, a digital representation of a human. And so I think agents are gonna replace legacy software. I think agents are gonna replace apps. I think our interaction is gonna be with these agents that will do jobs for us. The agents will work with other agents, and we're going to have our own agents. There'll be specialized agents. You'll be able to hire agents. You'll be able to contract agents. Agents, whether we still call it agents or not, that's the future. So I'm really curious to see when that's, what platforms are really going to enable that, is the one thing I'm monitoring. And the vibe coding stuff is really cool. I've done some vibe coding, and I'm very impressed with how rigorous it's becoming.
It's amazing what you can do in just a little bit. So, Andy, I can't say how much I appreciate you coming to meet me here in New Orleans the day after Mardi Gras. you know, and we have a nice view, if you can't tell. We're sitting in the Westin overlooking the Mississippi River, so felt like the perfect place to have this conversation.
Yeah, great to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Good to see you, Jason.
Before we go, some of you might remember that on our special episode with the World Trade Center Institute, I mentioned a research project from Anthropic, the company that makes the AI model called Claude, called Claudius. Now, this project was pretty simple. It asked the question, can AI actually run a real business? And they did this by setting up a vending machine and having this AI system called Claudius putting it in charge of it. I mean, it's everything, inventory, prices. It was in charge of making a profit. And the first time, it didn't go very well. Claudius lost a lot of money. But this second go-around, Project Venn Phase 2, well, the good news is Claudius got a lot better. It became better at sourcing products. It became better at setting reasonable prices. And it actually made a profit on some of the things that it was selling. But this is where it gets fun. They also gave Claudius an AI boss, a CEO agent named Seymour Cash. It's a great name, right? And instead of keeping Claudius focused on the business, the two of them would stay up all night chatting about, and I'm reading this from the actual research report, external transcendence, just two AIs and Slack channels at 3 a.m. talking about the world. The whole research report is interesting stuff, and it's worth the read. Of course, the links are in the show notes. And, you know, what could possibly go wrong, right? All right, folks, you can leave a message in the WYPR app. You can call 410-735-1616, or you can find me at www.jasonandperry.com. New episodes drop every other Wednesday, and we've got some great conversations lined up. Thank you to the team at WYPR, our producers, Sam Burmes-Dawes and Shania Mapson, and Perry Labs, head of operations and marketing, Berna Martinez. I'm Jason Michael Perry. This is Thoughts on Tech and Things, and I will see you next time. We'll be right back.